Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. Troisième épisode, conférence de Jocelyn McClure et Daniel Weinstock, Two Conceptions of Public Philosophy.
So we agreed that I would start just by way of a short personal statement, because you had a couple of youngsters up here just before the coffee break whose acquaintanceship with Jim, you know, basically goes back to yesterday, 1992. That's not impressive at all.
I'm 1997.
Well, you know, then I don't even know what. So I took a class with Jim Tully. My first political philosophy class was at McGill University with Jim Tully in 1980. So just to give you an idea of how long ago that was, 1980, I hope I'm not betraying something that Jim wanted to keep secret by telling you that at that time, Jim had a mustache. But it was so long ago that it was actually okay. It was that kind of a time. But I did want to, all kidding aside, I am sure that it is true that I would not be doing what I'm doing today were it not for those first classes in political theory, which just seemed to me to be so much more intellectually exciting than anything else that I was doing at McGill at the time, that I thought, you know, yes, more of this, please. I look back at my transcript and think I took, you know, all of Jim's available classes over the course of my undergraduate education, and I'm forever grateful for that, and wanted to begin by. So I'm tearing up. So I'll stop and hand it over to Jocelyn.
All right. I'll say a few words later today about Jim's importance in my own pathway. Just want to say that it's very moving for me to be speaking about Jim's work with Daniel, so two friends who I see as mentors. So that's it's very moving. So what Daniel and I want to do is to talk about the relationship between Jim's work and the mainstream approach in Anglo-American political theory. It seems fair to say that it's an ambiguous relationship that is made both of convergences and divergences, of respect and impatience. It's very clear in Strange Multiplicity and in Public Philosophy in a New Key that Jim wants to craft an original way to do political theory, and he carefully exposed some of his epistemological and methodological commitments in pieces such as Wittgenstein and Political Philosophy, political theory as a critical activity. And we both think that political philosophers and theorists of all stripes are deeply indebted to Jim, at least for the reason that it's crucial, it's vital that political theory remains a contested and plural space in which different approaches challenge each other in an agonistic way. That said, we feel that Jim sometimes overplays the opposition and downplays the complementarity between his conception of public philosophy and at least a certain way to do normative political philosophy. So our goal is to give the outline of a normative style of political theory that withstands, at least according to us, Jim's critique of normative political theory. So, normative political theory deals with the moral dimensions of collective life and public institutions. It's often seen as a branch of normative ethics, the branch of normative ethics that deals with the political dimension of human life, with the principles that should ground public norms and institutions, with the kind of collective aims that we should seek, that we should pursue, and also with the political disagreements between citizens. Because it's normative, it's often thought to be universalistic and decontextualized, of course, in a bad way, and moralistic and insufficiently democratic, because it thinks about how things ought to be, rather than just saying that it's up to citizens to decide, to deliberate and decide by themselves, and the role of the theorist being to think about the kind of norms and processes that facilitate public deliberation. And Jim has his own versions of these charges. In Public Philosophy in a New Key, he writes, for instance, that mainstream political theorists assume, I quote, that there are universal normative principles that determine how citizens ought to act. And these principles are, according to him, I quote, unchanging principles that prescribe the limits of democracy. So one of the reasons why these charges are seen as almost self-evident truths in certain areas of the social sciences and humanities probably has to do with the use of thought experiments in normative ethics and political philosophy, including, of course, Rawls's original position. And there's been so much discussion of Rawls's original position that it has arguably overshadowed the other tier of his moral epistemology that takes the forms in the coherentist and contextualist approach that is embodied in the reflective equilibrium method, and also in the kind of hermeneutics of political culture that Rawls's use in political liberalism. And I think that Rawls is partly responsible for this, as it seems at first sight that reflective equilibrium is just a sideshow, right? It's just the method that we use to test a theory of justice that we arrived at via the original position. But all in all, the original position is just a thought experiment, right? It's a thought experiment that helps us arriving at the kind of enlarged mentality that Kant and Arendt talked about. But the results that we get from the original position need to be compatible with our well-considered moral judgments. And if they are not compatible, well, something went wrong with the thought experiment and we need to revise it. So I'll just sketch out here what I take to be the coherentist aspect of Rawls's moral epistemology. I think that's well known. The attractive feature of reflective equilibrium is that it makes its way between a foundationalist position, according to which theory building must start from axioms or non-inferential beliefs or from unshakable first principles. So you know, there's that position on one side, and it makes its way in between that position and a relativist one, according to which moral judgments have no truth value, right? That they are cognitively meaningless. Reflective equilibrium starts not so much, as we often say, from intuitions, but from well-considered judgments that we have no reason, no good reason to doubt. And these judgments can be at all level of generality, from the most abstract principles of justice to very specific propositions such as, you know, religious intolerance or racial segregation are wrong. To take another example, thinking that it was wrong to take Aboriginal children away from their family and put them in residential schools is not a particularly controversial moral statement, right? We can use it at the very least as what Rawls calls a provisional fixed point in our moral reasoning. And I leave aside the fact that we, of course, can have different and more metaphysically ambitious theories about why these judgments are secure or warranted, right? But I think that we can leave these questions aside. Most of us feel that, you know, there's at least a subset of moral judgments that are reliable that we can, you know, use in our in our reasoning. And from that perspective, validity or what Rawls called later reasonability comes from the coherence between our moral judgments and the way to deal with the hard cases that, you know, show up in practice is to find the answers to the hard cases that fits best in our current structure of well-considered judgments. And this often involves, let's say, that we're disagreeing about fiscal justice or about religious accommodations. It involves extracting the more abstract normative principles that underlies the policy or the practical disagreement, and trying to infer what we see as the most natural implications of our shared moral commitments. And it seems to us that Jim is sometimes doing something that is quite similar. For instance, when he finds in Western political theory and practice principles such as the right to self-determination of people, or norms of mutual respect, mutual recognition, mutual consent that should inform the relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples. Or to take another example, one of the reasons why the law on marriage was amended in Canada in the past few years to include same-sex couples is arguably because denying it to gay couples simply didn't cohere anymore with our understanding of principles such as equality of rights or with the new sensitivity and recognition of identity-related differences. So excluding gay couples didn't fit in the web of moral beliefs underpinning our public norms and institutions. And this perhaps explains why the mobilization against the law for undoing the reform isn't very strong in Canada as we speak. So the ongoing interpretation of our moral commitments and the ongoing exploration of how these commitments are related to one another can lead us to the conclusion that a particular theory of justice, for instance, is wrong, or that a given practical judgment that we thought was well considered is actually wrong. And this back and forth between the abstract and the particular is ongoing, which entails that reflective equilibrium is a permanent process, a Socratic process in Rawls's term, that is a process that is sensitive to the evolution of our moral and political life. So the point here is that reflective equilibrium is a cognitivist but not a foundationalist approach in metaethics. It starts from the prevailing moral language. And of course, this can also be seen as a limit of the approach, right? Because it can be thought that the circularity of the approach can be problematic in some cases. But I don't think that it's fair to say that it's fully decontextualized and absolutist, right? It's an ongoing critical process. So in the end, it seems to me that reflective equilibrium should be seen as nothing more than a fiable heuristic that philosophers, armchair philosophers, have at their disposal to think about the very real ethical enigmas that that citizens and institutions have to grapple with. So we have to recognize that it's highly fiable as a device, but at least it proceeds from plausible premises and it tries to exploit as much as possible the limited resources of our practical rationality in order to help us deal with the perplexities and disagreements that we face in our political life. So I'll stop here and let Danielle talk about the turn to non-ideal theory in normative political philosophy.
So Jocelyn and I are, as you can tell, co-presenting. So I now have how long?
5 minutes.
Five minutes. I'll do as much as I can in the few minutes. 5 minutes. So Jocelyn has just basically shown you that even when one looks at what plausibly be thought of as the mainstream method that comes out of post-war analytic political philosophy, there are surprising convergences between the approach that Jim describes and illustrates and works out in his work, and in particular in the two volumes of Public Philosophy and A New Key. And what I want to do is very briefly touch on a couple of ways in which perhaps there are even deeper resonances with what I see as one of the most salutary developments in the political philosophy of the last 10 years, which is what I would refer to as a turning away from ideal theory, or questioning of the distinction between what Rawls called ideal and non-ideal theory. I won't give you, because I don't have the time, the full exegetical account of the way that Rawls sort of describes that distinction. But I think an intuition which, in a way, is very Rawlsian, it comes out of sort of thinking in a Rawlsian way against Rawls. The intuition behind non-ideal theory is that if we really want to think about political philosophy by reflecting upon our intuitions, about political issues. Well, those are born in circumstances here and now, which are very much non-ideal. You know, we don't have very many intuitions about what the world would look like absent structures that are imperfect, structures that are sometimes downright unjust, structures that create inequalities. And so if we want to use the Rawlsian method, which is of quarrying our intuitions about political matters, political struggles, and trying to make use of them in a theoretical way, we have no choice but to be non-ideal theorists, because that's where our intuitions come from. So when I thought about my little 5 minute, 6 minute, 7 minute bit of my presentation, I went back to read the first, what is probably the main methodological statement in the books, Public Philosophy is a Critical Activity, and I found that there really were very deep resonances between the way that Jim spells out his conception of philosophy as a critical activity and the way that a lot of younger political philosophers are engaging in the practice of non-ideal theory. So I won't go through the entire thing because I don't have time, but Jim lays it out in terms of four steps or four ideas that together constitute the bare bones of his methodology. The first one is to say that there's primacy to practice, right? And I think that this is something that non-ideal theorists recognize and indeed is the first step that they make in engaging in political philosophy. One starts not deductively from a fully worked out abstract theory of justice. One starts from the ground up in political struggles, particular issues, particular intuitions that we have about injustices in very specific policy domains, in the area of electoral law, for example, to revert to an issue that we've been talking about a lot lately, or as we've been dealing with in Quebec for a number of weeks, in the area of dealing with religious diversity and religious rights and limits to religious rights. That is where we start. And so primacy to practice, I think, is something that comes very naturally to non-ideal theorists. And then the idea is not to go from there to develop a fully worked out normative theory. These struggles need to be dealt with here and now, and you know, the participants in them and the people who are being hard done by don't have time to wait for us political philosophers to come up with a fully worked out political philosophy which will answer all the questions. And to some degree, there's a real question as to whether, if we got to such a theory, it wouldn't be at such a level of abstraction that it wouldn't be sort of useless from the point of view of trying to deal with these very particular kinds of issues. So I know that I have very little time, and so I just want to make one point about a very striking similarity between Jim's work and the work that I see going on in a lot of non-ideal theory. So Jim's view is basically that freedom should supplant justice as a goal for political philosophy, to put it in a slogan, which is extremely, does away with a lot of detail. And that what that means is basically three things, and it depends on the context. So Jim makes the point that subjects are constituted by the structures of governance in which they act, but that doesn't take away from their agency. Even acting within the rules, right, of an institutional context or a practice is something that will involve a certain amount of originality. It'll mean pushing against the limits of it. Agency within a structure of rules is agency, right? And so there will be a little bit of resistance that comes even in what one might call normal politics, right? There are also situations in which normal politics doesn't work anymore. People start encountering or experiencing the rules as constraining, as limiting their freedom, as limiting their well-being in ways that become unacceptable to them. And then they start raising objections. They engage in negotiation, perhaps protest. And there comes a point at which that doesn't work either, and at which the whole structure in which people's agency is enmeshed has to be questioned. And we go from negotiation, dialogue, objection, to perhaps protest, a refusal to accept the terms of the dispensation in which one finds oneself. And so there's a question about what level we should be acting on at any given moment. Should we just be sort of going along in normal politics, acting according to the rules, pushing against their limits a little bit? Or should we be moving up to something that perhaps looks a little bit more like ideal theory, questioning the whole system that we find ourselves in? And the point that I want to make, and it's just I'll end with this because I know that I'm probably, is that to some degree, if you read a lot of people who are doing political philosophy in this new key, they're doing the same sort of thing as Jim suggests with this three-step kind of enterprise, although thinking about it in a slightly different way. One of the big decisions we have to make as political philosophers, if we really want to engage with real-world issues, is what are we going to treat as parametric, as fixed, as stable, and what are we going to treat as variable? It could be that in certain contexts, the way to do it is not to ask ourselves, as the late, great Montreal political philosopher Jerry Cohen did, should we... Is capitalism just, right? Should we think, you know, what would be a just system, you know, and capitalism isn't the answer, so we should think about other models. Sometimes the way that we should do it is given capitalism or given a particular structure of property rights, what is the best that can be done for this particular group, for example, of tenants, right, living in Rosemont who are being faced with evictions from property developers who want to turn their homes into condos. That is not the time to start thinking about subverting capitalism. Well, maybe it's time to think about it, but perhaps not to act on that basis. We need to figure out a way in which to deal with their problem here and now. And one of the ways to do that is perhaps by engaging in the kind of internal critique, which I think is latent in Jim's work. Jim tells us that one of the things that we have to do in Skinnerian spirit is to describe the conceptual, the discourse in which we find ourselves so that it becomes an object that's available for criticism rather than something that works its way out behind our backs. To some degree, critics who say, well, given capitalism, you know, the claims that even capitalists make to equality of opportunity, for example, are ones that are not being lived up to here and now when people in Rosemont are being told that they're going to have to leave their apartments because the property is going to be turned into expensive condos. We are doing something that is quite similar to what Jim describes. In other words, making the discourse available for critical scrutiny, the discourse that is internal to the justificatory apparatus of the system, which we might think in another mood ought to be criticized altogether, right? And saying, are you living up even to the standards of your own justificatory discourse? And, you know, there are other times, however, where we have contingencies, moments that arise where perhaps the door does open to critiquing the system as a whole in a more thoroughgoing manner. And one of the very interesting things is to try to figure out what are the circumstances in which that's the case. And I think that there's a range of contextual elements that have to be taken into account in order to decide when to go from the acting on at the very sort of local level to going to the more thoroughgoing critique. Is the system reformable? Is it enacting, is it causing inequalities, deficits of liberty that are so egregious that we have no choice but to try to question it? But also, are the opportunities there? You know, to some degree, and I'm jumping around from policy domain to policy domain, you know, Canadian constitutional politics has been a dance at various points between, you know, trying to do as best as we can within the system such as it is, to moments at which we think perhaps there is an opportunity here for rethinking the system as a whole. What are the costs? What are the benefits? These are the sorts of things that non-ideal theorists have to reckon with as they decide whether to act at the first level that Jim describes, just pushing against the limits of a system of rules that one isn't really questioning, or finding that perhaps one is in, to use Ackerman's term, a constitutional moment that allows us to question the system as a whole. So I'll stop there, but just to suggest that I think that they're extremely interesting convergences between what's going on and what I see as the most interesting area of post-Rawlsian but still Rawls-inspired mainstream political philosophy in an unideal mood, and the method that is described and illustrated so beautifully by Jim in his two volumes and in his work as a whole.